Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print. For more, see www.computer.org/security or www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 47th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I am pleased to have with me my good friend Greg Morissette. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for having me.
Pleased to have you here. Greg Morissette is the Alan B. Cutting Professor of Computer Science at Harvard. He's also Associate Dean for Computer Science and Engineering. Greg and I grew up together in Kingsport, Tennessee, where we learned to code on Apple IIs, misbehaved in adolescence, and generally had a great time as members of the Alfred G. Packer Society. Greg is known for his work in programming languages, and in particular for the work he did while at Cornell on Cyclone. Greg's current work is on applications of advanced type systems, model checkers, certifying compilers, proof-carrying code, and inline reference monitors for building efficient and provably secure systems. He's also working on languages for sensor networks. Greg has a PhD in computer science from CMU. He's served on the NSF SICE Advisory Board and on DARPA's ISAT Board. He lives outside of Boston with his wife, Jack, and two kids. So, how you doing, Greg?
A little early. I'm doing okay, though. How about you?
I'm a little soggy because it's raining in Belgium this month. So, your early career focused lots of attention on the relationship between security and programming languages. Why do you think programming languages are important to software security?
Well, I think a lot of the problems that we've encountered over the last 20 years have been easily stopped, buffer overruns being the classic example. Like it or not, humans make a lot of mistakes when they code, and having tools that sort of automatically rule out, or at least in a fail-stop way, check for classes of errors makes a lot of sense. And something like a buffer overrun just couldn't happen in a properly implemented programming environment. So I think that's sort of the real genesis for a lot of the language stuff.
Mm-hmm. Making things just not able to happen in the first place.
Yeah. But the other reason is that there's actually, if you go back and you look at the early days of type abstraction and abstract data types, all this sort of stuff back in the 70s as it was being developed, people were really thinking about systems and had the same vocabularies like capabilities in the design of programming languages that they had in the design of security systems. So a lot of those ideas are being dusted off and revisited as a way to, enforce or provide a model for security in software today.
So there's this notion of type safety that seems important. And if you think about Java or C#, that's an important characteristic of those languages. Can you explain, first of all, what type safety is and why that's important, and then what other programming languages' properties can help with security?
I'll try. It turns out type safety is a pretty fuzzy notion because it's very relative. There are technical definitions that aren't all that useful. At a rough level, what it means is some notion of object integrity. At the end of the day, that I can only access an object either to read or write it using a proper capability. So I don't have to worry about somebody changing the state of some object in a type-safe language unless they have an accessible type-safe path to that object. And the reason that's so important is that if you go to reason about programs, either using a tool or even informally, you make assumptions about how that code is going to execute, and those assumptions follow a high-level model of evaluation. And as soon as an attacker can violate that model, they can really do essentially arbitrary things. So really what type safety is sort of the bottom line in a security policy. It's sort of the minimal amount that you need to get any kind of notion of integrity. Because without it, you can't, for example, even ensure that the code that you thought you were executing is what you're executing.
I guess that's one of the problematic aspects of C and other very low-level languages like assembly on steroids.
Yeah, I mean, it's the driving problem, I think, these days. But like I said, it's only the beginning. There's, as you know better than just about anybody, just because you've written code in a type-safe language doesn't mean the security problems go away. It does get rid of a set of baseline things, or at least transforms them into different sets of issues. But the point is that all of a sudden we have a firm footing to stand on when it comes to doing things like static analysis. If you, for example, do a static analysis on C, you have to be either extremely conservative. You don't even really know when you call this function that the bytes that make up the function definition haven't changed. That's an assumption that an analysis tool has to make, which could be a faulty assumption that an attacker can exploit.
So are there some other programming languages properties that are over and above or built on type safety that are important that can help with security that we all haven't heard so much about?
Yeah, I think there's a whole range of things. But I'll make a distinction between type safety and type abstraction. Many languages, in particular scripting languages, can be type safe without providing really good support for building type abstraction. So what that means is they're enforcing a certain execution model relative to the whole programming language, but not in an extensible way. You can't add new abstractions and reason about them in an application-specific way. Mm-hmm. Languages that support type, I mean, Java does provide some notions of type abstraction, and so that gives you a way to extend the language, the kinds of types that you have. But if you take something like pure scheme, for instance, you don't really have any mechanism for extending the vocabulary of the abstractions that you have.
Mm-hmm. Anything else that you can think of properties-wise?
Sure. So people have played around with a whole bunch of other exotic ideas. A good example is you hear about linear capabilities. The basic idea is that if I give you a type-safe reference to an object, that can serve as a capability. But in real capability systems, you need to be able to revoke a capability as well as hand
right.
it out. And you also want to make sure that just because I hand you a capability, you don't pass it along to someone else. And so you want to have a much more careful accounting of the capabilities. And linear type systems are a way that you can encode that kind of capability management in a way that you can't do with today's programming languages.
Interesting. So a ridiculous question, but in your opinion, what is the best programming language from a security perspective that's sort of widely available?
Oh, that is a ridiculous question.
I knew you'd like it.
I don't think that matters so much as the developers.
Even a bad developer can really screw up a good language.
Yeah, and vice versa. Really talented, good developers can take just about anything, and through a whole lot of discipline, produce something that is very robust. But not very cost-effective today to do that, because it doesn't scale at all.
Well, let's make an assumption. Let's assume we have a whole bunch of mediocre developers, and we can choose whatever language we want to aim at them. What would you pick?
It depends on context. If I had the luxury of a clean slate development where there were no constraints, I would probably pick C something like ML or Haskell, because they have really powerful type systems that let you capture more security relevant properties in the language. But they're not widely used. They may not provide the libraries or the functionality that you need. So then I would drop back to something that runs on the JVM or the CLR.
Right, right. So Java or C Sharp, something like that.
For example, yeah.
Yep.
And that's not really a choice. You could pick F Sharp as an example.
Of course.
But you don't, you know, the point is that the enforcement that you're actually getting is whatever the type system is at the VM level, not
exactly.
at the source level.
So is the choice of a programming language, or let's put it a different way since you just invoked the VM, is the choice of a reasonable VM more important than, say, code review?
Yeah, I think it is, because code reviewers, at least manual code review, just does not manage to catch off by one errors, null dereferences, all the, you know, the range of things that a good type system can rule out automatically as you develop.
Yeah, very good. So in some sense, some of these code review engines for C that are becoming popular are making up for the fact that C doesn't have a type system and enforcement is poor and null references happen all the time and so on.
Yep. But actually what's interesting is even languages like Java have not been well designed so that these tools can give them the most bang for the buck. A good example is null pointers, right? They're the most common error in Java, and they can lead to a denial of service attack if you identify an unexpected null pointer exception that you can trigger. And there are perfectly good language designs where not every reference has to have a nullable type, and you can actually end up with explicit checks in the type system that says, hey, you need to check for whether this thing is null before you dereference it, which would be completely unworkable as a design in Java, because every method invocation, every object reference would require a null check. But in languages like ML or Haskell, you don't have null as a default value for every single type. In fact, you rarely use them. And so the design allows you to rule out a whole class of errors by default in a way that, you know, makes type checking more effective.
So some aspects of your work have involved foisting formal systems into more widespread use. So in particular, I'm thinking about proof-carrying code and recalling with some fondness your classic debate with Dave Evans at the InfoSec Research Council. What role do formalisms have to play in software security? I mean, we've already begun to scratch the surface of that, but formalism is difficult for most people. So
yeah,
my
current research is really asking the question, 20 years from now, is it feasible that when you have a system that needs to be high assurance, can you mechanically prove that the code will respect a security policy, a detailed security policy? And this is, it's not at all clear to me that that goal is achievable. Which is why it's research. But I do think that amazing progress has been made in the last 5 to 10 years on a whole bunch of fronts that make it within the realm of feasibility for at least some classes of systems. And I think when you the level of assurance that you're getting out is incredibly high when compared to the kinds of processes that we use today.
Right, yep. Well, you know, we're basically kludging our way and getting lucky these days, I think.
Yeah, maybe. But
so,
one thing I never appreciated was some of these are social processes, and no technical advance will ever really replace the right, you know, picking the right developers, the right organization, the right design.
Right, yep. That's a good point.
We'll be right back after this message. Hi, this is Gary McGraw, host of the Reality Check podcast with Gary McGraw. This podcast series is focused on practical questions centered on running large-scale software security initiatives. Reality Check targets experienced leaders working to solve software security problems every day. Reality Check is sponsored by Sigital and syndicated by CSO Magazine. For more, see www.sigital.com/realitycheck.
So I believe it was your Cornell student, or maybe it was Fred's, who imported StackGuard to Microsoft, kind of in the form of the GS flag. Is that right?
Actually, no. One of our former undergrads was in charge of the C++ developer team that integrated that. I don't know who's actually responsible, but yeah. And that was a huge coup in the sense that, StackGuard is a really clever idea for getting a class of buffer overruns to be mitigated.
And Cornell was also involved in importing inline reference monitoring to Microsoft. And so kind of the question is, how common is tech transfer like this from academia to the commercial software world?
It's picking up rapidly. I mean, another good example is the native client stuff that Google developed recently is based on some work that a student from MIT who took my class developed, Stephen McCammon. I think these ideas, and if you look at static analysis tools, there's obviously a huge flow from research to practice right now. Mm-hmm. So it's picking up and it's accelerating in a way that's exciting. Part of that is maybe because of big research organizations like Microsoft. They have 600 PhDs now working on these kinds of clever tools.
It's a higher and deeper pile of piled higher and deeper.
Yeah. But I mean, I also think there's been a shift introduced by people like Dawson Engler and others who have, you know, managed to transition these ideas into the real world in a way that we academics are actually pretty bad at.
Right. So I wanted to talk about that a little bit and ask you what you do personally to try to influence the state of the practice in the commercial world. I know, for example, that you serve on a few advisory boards, including Fortify's, but what do you try to do to push things in that direction?
Well, actually, I mostly serve on those boards because I feel like I keep in touch that way with what the real problems are. It's easy as an academic to go off and get interested in technically interesting problems, but that aren't practically relevant. So in terms of influencing them, I don't know. I mean, sometimes I think all we do is provide an outside, fresh view on the way that they're thinking. Sometimes we can point people to new advances that they might be able to take advantage of, immediately. And I think part of that is, as academics, we end up reading and going to conferences and networking in a way that's different than people do typically inside of companies.
Mm-hmm. And then I suppose you also seed them with various students.
Yeah, actually that's the real influence, is we warp people's brains in college or in grad school, and then they go off to become developers and hopefully carry some of the ideas forward.
So I wanted
to, I think, only happen as generation shifts, you know.
Right.
a good example, so, is, say, garbage collection. You know, 20 years ago, people thought it was a ridiculous idea to incorporate in real systems, and
yeah.
Now it's taken for granted.
It's kind of funny because, you know, if you think about Lisp in 1956, we're talking about 1956.
Yep.
So you're right. It might even be multi-generational.
Exactly.
I wanted to shift gears a little bit and ask you some questions about your new work or what you're currently working on. What security and information control issues are posed by sensor networks?
Oh, lots of stuff. Although I haven't been worrying about that as much because, sensor networks, at least in the setting that I've been working with Matt Welsh, are you know, hard enough to program without even thinking about security. So even in benign environments.
I'm going to hold that against you. But
you're absolutely right. People have not been thinking about this. But a good example is on some of these sensors, you can't afford, you don't have the power budget to even do reasonable crypto for some of the communications that you're doing. So that makes it a real challenge. And then there are really interesting privacy issues. So Matt has set up a really interesting network around Cambridge of a whole bunch of sensors on light poles. And we'd like to turn those sensors loose to the community and let people write applications that maybe they could do weather monitoring or traffic or pollution monitoring, but you know, then
they're tracking their friends or stalking.
Exactly,
people.
Right. So I think we are going to have these platforms and people need to be thinking about these security and privacy issues from the very beginning.
Well, we're counting on you, Morissette. Come on.
Well, no, but my focus there has shifted too, because now we're working on robo bees. These aren't movable sensor networks. Lightweight, about the size of a dragonfly, robotic insects that could fly around and do various tasks as a swarm and
like spy on people in the shower. I like it. This is great.
There we go. Now this is a big $10 million. Grant from NSF that's really exciting because it draws across a range of fields from biology. We have biologists on there who are studying how insect flight actually works, to neurology, what do insect brains look like, how can we replicate those, to swarm computing, to security and reliability issues.
Very cool. Sounds like fun, actually.
It is.
So you guys, at this point, aren't really taking into account rogue sensors and misinformation and misuse and, you know, all these sorts of awful things you can think about doing if you had a network of little tiny bugs everywhere.
No, not yet. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, early internet days. The things that are wired up in these sensor networks are for typically scientific applications, like volcano monitoring or pollution monitoring, this sort of thing.
I think it'd be great to make people believe a volcano was going to happen when it wasn't. I don't know about you.
That's a great idea, actually.
You're just not evil enough. I tried to teach you when we were kids.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, those networks are out there, and they're going to get connected to the internet, and you're increasingly going to have not just sensors, but actuators.
Yeah. The volcano attack is a good one because you get the population to leave and then you take all their stuff while they're gone.
Ooh, that is good.
Hey, I got a new idea for a grant.
Yeah, no kidding.
or a grant application. So, so you've provided more than your share of service to the research community, and we're all grateful for that. But we're a little confused because we're not sure exactly what the SAIS board does for the National Science Foundation or what's involved in a DARPA ISAT besides seeing a bunch of classified cool crap.
So, no, I wish.
So let us know. How do those things work? What are they like?
Well, they're very different because NSF and DARPA couldn't be more different agencies for funding research. They're very complementary. For NSF, one of the things that the advisory board does is review the programs and make sure that NSF is doing its job with respect to computer science research, and trying to identify new areas where NSF might provide funding for research. Mm-hmm. A good example is the big push into computational economics and game theory. Mm-hmm. That's a new area that NSF has decided to invest in. But cybersecurity is a good example as well. Mm-hmm. And then at DARPA, you get a very different model because NSF hands out lots of little grants for the most part. And they're all peer-reviewed, which has a is very good in many ways, but has the effect of also making a lot of research somewhat incremental.
Mm-hmm.
For the same reason that getting a paper published can be hard, getting a peer-reviewed proposal funded is also very hard. Places like DARPA seem like they want to do more high visibility, high risk kinds of things, but they don't spread the money around as thinly as NSF does.
Mm-hmm. Meta question about all of this research funding stuff. Do you think that the United States will catch back up in funding science now that things are changing in Washington?
It certainly has improved a lot, but it's hard to tell whether that's a function of the Recovery Act or until it'll go away next year,
mm-hmm.
or whether it's going to really be sustained.
Right. I think it needs to be sustained or we're going to be in trouble in the States.
Yeah, but I'm completely biased in that regard. So, and obviously we have sort of profit by that. So,
yeah, more money equals good. And then last and final and probably most important question in terms of monetizing this podcast later for me, what's the most embarrassing story that you can tell about our joint childhood fund?
Embarrassing for you?
Even more importantly, how much will you pay me to keep the other one secret?
Yeah, I was going to say, is it embarrassing for you or me?
This is your chance to decide.
To call me up, and I'll be happy to tell them many stories about you. Many, many stories.
You can't think of any?
Well, I can think of many, but I'm not sure that it would be appropriate for me to...
You'd have to admit that you were there.
Exactly. Maybe that's it. I do remember, you know, one of my favorite times growing up is Gary always had really good parties at his house. And there was a really, really good party one time where there was a bonfire outside. And some idiot decided to pour gasoline on the...
That was John Ress.
On the fire... was that John? Yeah, on the firewood.
Yeah, it was.
And then I told everybody to step back that I would light it, and I struck the match, and this huge fireball happened, and I burned off my eyebrows and arm hair and that sort of thing.
Well, we're glad that it's grown back by now.
I'm not sure it has, but...
Well, thanks, Greg. It's been a fun interview.
Thank you.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by InformIT. S&P's March-April issue examines mobile security and reliability. What can be done to prevent cell phones and PDAs? Sorry, let's talk that back in. 3, 2. S&P's March-April issue examines mobile security and reliability. What can be done to protect cell phones and PDAs and the data on them? Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.